because all the dead were young. But it's not. These are the names of those who were killed trying to escape from East Germany after the building of the Berlin Wall.
A complex and often challenging history, Germany, Memories of a Nation, begins here on BBC Radio 4, next Monday morning at 9:45.
On Longwave and DAB Radio now, it's time for the Daily Service, led by Michael Wakelin. On FM, Damian Lewis begins our new book of the week, Tennessee Williams' Mad Pilgrimage of the Flesh, the acclaimed biography of the great American dramatist by the theatre critic John Lahr. Trevor White is the voice of the playwright.
On March 31st, 1945, at the Playhouse Theater on 48th Street, on the unfashionable side of Broadway, the curtain rose on the sold-out opening night of The Glass Menagerie. Tennessee Williams, the show's 34-year-old playwright, sat in the aisle seat of the sixth row. Wearing a gray flannel suit with a button missing, a wad of green shirt, and a pale conservative tie, he seemed, according to one paper, like a farm boy in his Sunday best. Eddie Dowling, a jug-eared 51-year-old actor, was improbably cast as Tom Wingfield, the play's young narrator. He was also the show's co-director and co-producer. Dowling went into the opening speech brazenly, announcing Williams's visionary powers. "Yes, I have tricks in my pocket. I have things up my sleeve. But I am the opposite of a stage magician. He gives you illusion that has the appearance of truth. I give you the truth in the pleasant disguise of illusion. To begin with, I turn back time." As the lights faded out on Dowling, they faded in on Lorette Taylor as Amanda, the matriarch of the hapless Wingfield family. The reception for Taylor was deafening. On the eve of her 61st birthday, she was returning to Broadway after a 5-year hiatus. Known as the alcoholic of alcoholics, only 90 minutes before curtain up, Dowling and his wife turned into the alley leading to the stage door and saw Lorette. She was slumped on the steps, with the rain dripping from the roof onto her. She was drunk and wringing wet like a cat that's been locked out all night. They walked Taylor around, feeding her black coffee and stewed tomatoes from a can. Finally, an hour later, they got her into her dressing room where she took a shower. On stage, the thunderous applause sent Taylor so far off course that she jumped into the second act, and Dowling, now acting her son Tom, had to guide her back. Dowling recalled, "I said, 'Ma, come on now,' and she came back like a little terrier." A bucket had been placed in the wings for Taylor. The few minutes she had between scenes, she was leaning over and retching horribly. From his sixth-row seat, Williams soon realized that he was present at a special occasion. He was struck by Taylor.
"I had never seen a performance like it in my whole life. It was something like out of another world."
Illumination and revelation coalesced in Taylor as the character Amanda worried about her children and invoked her long-lost life of youth and hope. Taylor seemed to transform into light the punishing suffocation and loss of Williams's own haunted household. Throughout his life, Tennessee Williams, who was the most autobiographical of American playwrights, always approached his typewriter in the same way.
"I begin with a character in a situation, a vague one. If I have a problem, I invent people in parallel circumstances, create parallel tensions. It is my way of working out problems."
By the end of each writing day, he wrote for up to 8 hours at a time, manuscript pages were scattered across his desk and at his feet. This disarray made a larger symbolic point. His mess was now outside him. On stage and off it, hysteria was Williams's idiom.
"I have a vast traumatic eye set in my forehead center that tortures to its own design all images that enter.
His plays put those images on stage and made a spectacle of his haunted interior. Each play, he felt, registered.
The climate of my interior world at the time in which it was written, I took to the theater with the impetus of a compulsion. I found that I had a stage inside me. Actors appeared out of nowhere and took the stage over.
At the time of his conversion to drama, in his early 20s, Williams had not seen more than two or three professional productions. For two decades, however, he'd had a ringside seat at some unforgettable and indigestible family scenes. He was born Tom Williams into a hate-filled parental drama, a theater of war in which the children were stunned witnesses. In a sort of seance with the ghosts of his past, his family's narratives and their voices were perpetually reworked into his cast of characters and formed what the novelist Gore Vidal astutely called his basic repertory company. They were his benevolent grandparents, the Reverend Walter Dakin and Rosina Dakin, known as Grand, in whose various Southern Episcopal rectories Williams had spent his early life, his feared and frequently absent traveling salesman father, Cornelius Coffin Williams, known as C.C., his prim and protective mother, Miss Edwina, his younger brother, Dakin, and his older blighted sister, Rose, who at the age of 33 was given one of the first prefrontal lobotomies in America. And then there was Williams himself, with his own irreconcilably divided nature. The pinched world of the glass menagerie, with its alley and fire escape, its second-hand furniture, is a poetic, if not literal, representation of the Williams family's existence in St. Louis. The family moved there in 1918 when Williams was 7, so that C.C. could accept a management position with the International Shoe Company. The family's impoverishment was as much emotional as material. Back in Mississippi, the Williamses had been part of a minister's household, a patrician bulwark of the local community. St. Louis dislocated them not just from place, but also from prestige. The abrasions of anonymity and middle-class city dwelling were unsettling for everyone, but especially unconscionable for a snob like Edwina, who was born in Ohio, but adopted the style and manners of a Southern belle. When Edwina set up house in St. Louis, she was 34. She had been married to C.C. for 11 years. It was the first time that the family lived under one roof away from her parents. For different reasons, both members of the couple were soon disappointed and furious. C.C. took refuge from his hurt and excessive drink. Edwina, a teetotaler, showed her umbrage through excessive propriety. The result was war. Williams's eloquence, like his neurotic nature, was part of his family inheritance. While the family's violence shaped his personality, its fluency shaped his prose. He grew up saturated in the rich linguistic brew of biblical imperative. His beloved grandfather, the Reverend Dakin, had a mellifluous voice and was something of a ham in the pulpit. Edwina was as wordy as her father. Though she wasn't just a talker, she was a narrative event, a torrent of vivid, cadenced, florid, and confounding speech that could not be denied. Eloquence was a show of power amid her powerlessness. A large word hoard was part of a Southern belle's arsenal of seduction. As she launches into a story about her 17 legendary gentlemen callers, Amanda tells Tom in the glass menagerie,
"It wasn't enough for a girl to be possessed of a pretty face and a graceful figure. She also needed to have a nimble wit and a tongue to meet all occasions. Never anything coarse or common or vulgar."
Edwina's wall of words was designed to keep the world at attention and at bay. Edwina was, as Williams politely characterized her in his memoir, a moderately controlled hysteric. And, like many hysterics, she was frigid. Like Amanda, Edwina used her children as vessels into which she emptied the desires and the fears of her frustrated heart. For a long time, Williams and Rose struggled to maintain their image as dutiful, well-mannered representations of their mother's hopes. Rose, in Edwina's romantic fantasy, was a Southern belle and wife-to-be. Likewise, in The Glass Menagerie, Amanda orders her daughter, the crippled, dateless Laura, to sit.
I want you to stay fresh and pretty for gentlemen callers.
I'm not expecting any gentlemen callers.
Laura knows her disability debars her from a normal life.
But, Mother, I'm crippled.
Nonsense, Laura. I've told you never, never to use that word. Why, you're not crippled. You just have a little defect, hardly noticeable even.
Before Laura's eyes and ours, Amanda fictionalizes the world and insists that her children deny the truth. From the day she bought her chronically shy 12-year-old son a $10 typewriter, Williams was my rotten son. In a real sense, Williams the writer was dreamed up by the disappointed Edwina. For Williams, storytelling became a kind of collusion, an attempt to live up to his mother's vivacity, her way of imagining, and her sense of him. The horrible family atmosphere was also a recipe for madness. According to Williams, Rose had the same precarious balance of nerves that I have to live with, but no outlet for them. Gradually and inexorably, she descended into her own unreachable world. In Williams's eyes, Rose's lobotomy was, to some degree, a result of Edwina's sexual hysteria, an enforcement of radical innocence through the surgical removal of the part of the brain that remembers.
Mother chose to have Rose's lobotomy done. My father didn't want it. In fact, he cried. It's the only time I saw him cry.
Rose's lobotomy transformed her into a ghost of her former self. That ghostliness is built into The Glass Menagerie, in which shards of memory play out the narrator's internal drama. At the finale, the narrator stands before the audience as a haunted man, hounded by figments of his internal world. The stage becomes almost dance-like, a hallucinatory tableau vivant in which Williams transforms what he called my doomed family into a form of glory. Instead of being overwhelmed by the memories of family madness, the narrator is now in control of his own internal turmoil. In the last line of the play, he says, "Blow out your candles, Laura, and so goodbye." Laura does as she's told. The silent, final gesture demonstrates the narrator's dramatic prowess. It also broadcasts Williams' dramatic goal, to redeem life through beauty from the humiliation of grief. When the final curtain came down on the Broadway opening of The Glass Menagerie, the audience knew that some kind of theater history had been made. The cast took 24 curtain calls. To the young playwright Arthur Miller, The Glass Menagerie augured what he called a revolution in New York theater. It was not only the American theater that was reborn. Edwina Williams, to whom her dutiful son gave half his royalties, was also reborn, liberated by her new wealth to leave her disastrous marriage. And overnight, in the public's mind, Tom Williams was reborn as Tennessee Williams, playwright.
Damian Lewis will continue reading Tennessee Williams' Mad Pilgrimage of the Flesh by John Lahr tomorrow. Trevor White was the voice of Tennessee Williams, Elaine Claxton, Amanda, and Beatrice Jones, Laura. The abridger was Richard Hamilton, and the producer was Elizabeth Allard. In a couple of minutes, it's Woman's Hour and this.
Two old friends having lunch.
Oh, so our favourite table.
Yeah, excellent.
He's unhappily married. She's still playing the field.
It's early days.
I respect. Oh, so you have met someone.
Starring Claire Skinner and Stephen Mangan.
What do you think would have happened when we first met and shared the flat? Of
one Sunday afternoon all those years ago.
The new series of Lunch on BBC Radio 4, this Monday to Friday at 10:45 in the morning and again at 7:45 in the evening.